Hi, everyone. Welcome to the third panel of the day. It's entitled, as you know, since you're here, Complicating the Narrative, Teaching the Algerian War. And our first speaker is going to be Jessica Hammerman. Jessica is an assistant professor of world history at the Central Oregon Community College. She received her PhD in history from the City University of New York in 2013. And her dissertation was on Jews and the Algerian War. And she's now working on a book manuscript called The Heart of the Diaspora, Jews and the Algerian War, 1954-1962. And she has an article that just came out in Archives Juives in March this year, Des Juifs Algériens contre la Torture en Algérie. And her contribution to this panel is entitled Imperialism and as Pedagogy, Jewish Leaders in the 1950s and Crémieux's Legacy. Just so you know, this is the PowerPoint presentation prepared by the third speaker, not by Jessica nor Lindsay, who will come after her. Jessica, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and thanks everybody for being here. So Adolphe Crémieux saw himself as an emancipator of Jews throughout Europe and the Middle East when, in 1870, he secured citizenship for all the Jews of Algeria, at least in the Algeria of that time, before it was expanded south. The Crémieux Decree, as it was called, is what made the Algerian Jews of the North unique, setting them apart from other North African Jews. The decree, from its inception in 1870 to 1962, when the large majority of Jewish Algerians repatriated to France, offers a crucial lens through which to study the complex, multifaceted nature of French imperialism. Imperialism has a pedagogical side, and here's where it fits in here. The purpose of a civilizing mission was to educate the native population on how to be more French, more European, and to educate the settlers on how to do the same, right? Like Jules Ferry, Adolphe Crémieux spent much of his career helping to emancipate through education, secular French education, for Jews throughout the Middle East and North Africa through the Alliance schools. The civilizing mission is an educational mission. When we think about teaching and the Algerian War, we must imagine various populations teaching and learning what it meant to be French, and eventually, when the FLN came in and was challenging that idea, what it would mean to be Algerian. Algerian Jews were students and teachers on both sides of these, and their positions bring into focus the blurriness of these two categories, French and Algerian, reminding us to tread carefully when teaching the war today. Henri Rousseau in the Vichy Syndrome described textbooks and school history programs as the mode of social transmission par excellence. In our history classes, students learn about decolonization, but in America, it is essential for them to understand the workings of imperialism before they can begin to comprehend the momentum and the violence during the Franco-Algerian War. I first proposed this panel on how to teach the Algerian War because I fear that it still can be taught as a binary of nationalisms, the French versus the Algerians. The truth, as we are all aware in this room, was complicated. Multiple populations rested on some kind of hybrid identity, and it's better to see things as on a spectrum. For instance, Jews of the Sahara were still indigenous up until 1962, at the very end. Muslim Harkis were French, and some activists for independent Algeria were Christian or secular. Still, it's undeniable that the French imperial hierarchy, which formed over decades, trained inhabitants of Algeria to see themselves in terms of ethnicity or religion. In his refutation of the skewed power dynamic, Frantz Fanon and other intellectuals like him repeated this binary as they advocated on behalf of the Third World. Fanon is an excellent primary source for students, but we shouldn't repeat his assertions as if they were sociological facts. An approach to teaching that only speaks of the Algerians versus the French can be misleading. Throughout the entire colonial period, French officials were categorizing, policing, and separating. Part of the French occupation of Algeria involved recasting the roles of what Algeria would be, who would live there, and who would have that land. People, bureaucrats and others played immense language games throughout the 19th century, the most obvious being that Algeria is part of metropolitan France. that Muslim personal status was some kind of a privilege, or that Europeans had a right and that they had a duty to civilize. Even language eludes us. Who were the Algerians anyway? Until the mid-20th century, the colons were called Algerian. In one testimony, a young French-Algerian boy reported that he'd never heard the word at all until 1950. Meanwhile, colonial authorities, the press, and others were convinced that all inhabitants of Algeria were naturalized as French, and if the Muslim majority didn't share the benefits of citizenship, then that was because they preferred to maintain a Quranic status. In many ways, Jewish inhabitants of Algeria have been written out of the official history. Arabization, which was a government-driven effort to homogenize and identify who would be Algerian, happened with concerted effort after independence. Specifically in 1965, Boumediene instituted a policy that would flatten Algeria's diversity in an attempt to unify the new nation. So what has happened to this story of the Jews in Algeria? And why does this story matter for contemporary Algeria or contemporary France? For today's project, I'm interested in how this 130-year history of French-Algerian Jews evolved and was also retold in the 8 years of the Franco-Algerian War. Like Boumediene and Jacques Soustelle, Jewish leaders too recast their own past in the tense years of war, when no one was sure what Algeria would become. FLN advocates, the French press, and Jewish leaders within Algeria changed the way that they described 19th century Jewish colonization between 1954 and 1962. Crémieux, the man, and Crémieux, the Crémieux decree, became the symbolic axis around which these debates revolved. One example of the deep connection between imperialism and education in the 19th century was the way that French ministers entered Algeria. They entered Jewish schools to, quote unquote, clean them of disease. This intimate intrusion demonstrated not just an anti-Jewish sentiment that says that Jews are dirty, but it also intimates that Jews had the potential for regeneration. This house cleaning was the first of many steps that eventually led to Jewish naturalization. By the 1920s, the Jewish population in Algeria was increasing, and it was clear that French naturalization had been beneficial. They had improved health, they sported modern clothes, they spoke French. Within 50 years of their naturalization, the Jewish population had more than doubled. As the empire began to fall apart during the Algerian War, many Jewish leaders struggled to find ways to preserve their French citizenship as Algeria divided away from France. Both nations were trying desperately to redefine themselves, and the FLN and French nationalists drew on ideas about the Jews and pulled them into a battle of loyalties. Their unusual historical relationship to colonialism made Jewish Algerians easy targets for Muslim colonial subjects, as well as French colons. To some observers, it seems that they could slide either way, that they would do so as an entity, following the tradition of Crémieux. Theoretically, they stood out from both groups, although there were many positive interactions, including intermarriages with colons and perhaps an exaggerated communal give and take between Muslims and Jews. When Vichy leaders wanted to summarily exclude the Jews from the political community, it was easy for the government to overturn the single Crémieux decree, making Jews indigenous subjects once again. So Crémieux's imperial imprint was so strong that when he died, there was space for new secular Jewish leaders to fill in. Even after World War II, American Jewish organizations stepped in, and rabbis and religious leaders were not seen as representing the community. One Jewish leader and a focus of my book, Jacques Lazarus, fashioned himself as a 20th century Crémieux, stepping in as spokesperson for Algerian Jews while still approaching the local problems from a squarely metropolitan perspective. Maud Mandel, in her new book, recently argued that Lazarus had constructed a Jewish story to the Algerian War. He did this by underlining Jewish names in the news and by narrating the story for the press. Most importantly, though, what Lazarus did was serve as a French advocate on behalf of the Algerian Jews. And not unlike Crémieux, he devoted his life to Jewish politics while claiming they didn't exist. He argued repeatedly that Algerian Jews were simply a part of the French community, even while representing a Jewish perspective, whenever anyone claimed that they were a distinct group. In so doing, Lazarus was teaching the international Jewish community, French leaders, and Algerian rebels how to talk about Jews from Algeria. The simplest answer was, they are French. In the mid-1950s, Lazarus and other Jewish leaders strode extreme deference to Crémieux, legitimizing his legacy. Two pieces stand out from 1955, the year that commemorated the 75th anniversary of Crémieux's death. The first was an article by Raymond Benishoux that appeared in July, and the second was a lecture given by André Chiraki in December. Both pieces credited Crémieux with making Algerian Jews into French citizens almost single-handedly. Both pieces give equal weight to Crémieux's biography and his political accomplishments. They emphasize personal details about him, exploring the nuances of his face, the furrow of his brow, and his gaze. Both pieces sought to make the point that even though he was Jewish and French, Crémieux stood for emancipation from East to West. He was also celebrated for his bravery. These 20th century leading Algerian Jews celebrated Crémieux's decree as a moment when the French Empire came to them personally. The 1950s imperialists tell a story of Algerian Jews welcoming the French as if the humanist secular West was reaching out to the Jews. And because of French values, the Jews of Algeria truly had the chance to become equal members of society. Jean Cohen, a Jewish activist for Algerian nationalism in the 1950s, explained how the 19th century Algerian Jews welcomed the French. He wrote, quote, "The French brought not just Frenchness, but humanity. And to assimilate to France was much more profound than becoming French. It meant becoming human." Cohen's perspective shows that by the 50s, it wasn't possible for many Northern Algeria Jews to just shed their French identities. This was part of who they were. Eager to be universal, to be men and women like others, their 19th century forebears weren't necessarily shunning their Judaism. They were welcoming for the first time their humanity. They had all but forgotten the way the military and government converged on intimate spaces, exaggerating ethnic and cultural differences. Even Cohen, who had taken a stance against the French occupation in the Algerian War, had to acknowledge how beneficial becoming French had been for him and his family. André Chiraki remarked that Crémieux's birth coincided with the French Revolution, which had made all Jews into France's children. Thanks to Crémieux, French Jews were world leaders in universal Judaism, in obtaining human rights for Jews around the world. Crémieux inherited the ambiguities of the French Revolution, in which French statesmen strived to bring French citizenship and culture to Jews around the world. What goes without saying is that the imperial project, which fashioned French identity as an export, brought so much destruction, conquering property, cultural practices, and setting up economic disparities that would endure for centuries. Chiraki's article whitewashes the controversies surrounding Crémieux. It credits him with granting French sovereignty to his elders, while it also claims that, quote, "Crémieux was just complying with the wishes of Algeria's French leaders, with an act of faith that would eventually grant citizenship overall." This public idea, which became increasingly impossible, where Jews wished both Muslims and Christians the very best to live in peace, became widespread, even as it was impossible to reconcile. So just as the FLN began to challenge Jewish belonging in France by asking them to claim their true home, which was Algeria, most Jewish spokesmen did not question their own belonging within France. Instead, they held 1789 closer, even as the followers of Drumont and Saint-Simon protested the Jews' place in French Algeria in the name of nationalism. By the time the Vichy regime overturned the decree in 1940, this marked an unimaginable trauma for many Algerian Jews. "In my family," wrote Jean Daniel, the Nouvelle Observateur editor, "we were French, not just because Crémieux decree decided that Jews should be French in 1870, but because we were raised as if we had always been French." The FLN also focused on the Crémieux decree in order to show the way that the colons reacted. In October 1956, the FLN solicited local rabbis and community leaders to speak on behalf of the Jews in support of the as yet unborn Algerian nation. Their strategy was to blame outsiders for any tensions that existed between Muslims and Jews in Algeria. The letter of appeal, known as the Soumam Appeal, blames the French government, the politics of the Middle East, and imperialist ideology for the Judeo-Muslim tension. Revisiting recent history, the Algerian nationalists wrote, quote, "Without wishing to go back too far into history, we nevertheless deem it useful to recall the era when, in France, the Jews were considered less than animals, not even possessing the right to bury their dead, but forced to dispose of them clandestinely at night." The writers were not wrong, of course. They were asking the public to thoroughly examine the interactions between Jews of Algeria and the French state. In doing so, the FLN Soumam Appeal was its own sort of re-education program. So, in response to the appeal, there was a declaration on behalf of the Jewish community by Jacques Lazarus. And he stated a very watered-down, ambiguous version of the Jewish perspective. He wrote, quote, "The Jews instead intend to stay loyal to the vocation that has made them equally close to the other two religious communities, Muslims, and Christians. Their firm hope is to continue to live in friendship with both. The declaration clarified that what they wanted was a Crémieux decree for Muslims, highlighting a popular saying among the community, quote, "The higher the French representatives elevate Muslim populations, the grander the satisfaction of the Jewish population feels in our country." These Jewish community representatives continue to rely on the vision of Crémieux as emancipator, even as it became clear that the decree was but an arm of the French imperial project. In an important speech in early 58, Lazarus lamented the fact that the Crémieux decree, which made us who we are today, had been decried by Europeans and Muslims alike. Meanwhile, other parties publicly questioned Jewish allegiances as the State of Israel emerged, especially in 1956. For instance, Le Monde published a particularly troubling article during the Suez Crisis, which asked, "Will the Muslim masses know the difference between Israelites and Israelis?" And then in 1958, de Gaulle himself made a faux pas as he listed the residents of Algeria: Kabyle, Arab, Shuaya, Mozabite, Jewish, and French, implying that the Jews of Algeria would make up a distinct nationality in the new federated Algeria, that they weren't really legitimately French. Once again, the issue of Jewish citizenship was at stake. Lazarus emphatically stated his perspective: "The only safeguard for the Jewish community has been their French citizenship." De Gaulle's federation, it was feared, may not have shielded Jews in the same way. French citizenship, Lazarus elaborated, was something that the Jews had long fought for, as recently as World War II against European fascists. Jews had fully internalized French citizenship, and the Crémieux decree was no longer necessary. Lazarus found it inconceivable that anyone even questioned the Jews' French identity nearly five generations after naturalization. So as Jewish representatives witnessed citizenship being given and taken away from Muslims, they also lobbied for the few hundred non-citizen Jews in the Mazab who eventually successful doing that. So later on in the war, about 5 years later, Lazarus and some of the very leaders who had celebrated Crémieux explicitly rejected their foundations as his heirs, instead defending their French citizenship as a fait accompli. By that time, Jewish leaders suspected that if Algeria gained independence, then the French citizens of Algeria would repatriate into metropolitan France. Their new priority was to defend the Algerian Jews belonging to the French citizenry as if it hadn't been granted under separate cover. While earlier articles had described Crémieux in a personal familial manner, the later articles discredited him explicitly in order to combat accusations of a Jewish conspiracy or of anti-Muslim racism. They wanted to portray their citizenship as a profound, unconditional quality, rather than associating French citizenship with the Crémieux decree, which had already shown that it could be easily reversed. So in a 1960 article commemorating the centennial of the Alliance, Polyakov criticized the naivete of the 19th century. Crémieux enacted his laws at a time when it was still possible to believe in the perfectibility of the universe, he wrote. However, he still claimed that of all the efforts to integrate Jews into larger society, the Alliance was the most successful one, because it simultaneously brought both French culture and Jewish culture to students all over the world. So in spite of his criticisms of 19th century naivete, the author still believed that the Alliance represented a universal truth, a universal effort to save Judaism. By February 61, toward the war's end, Lazarus's Algerian Jewish newspaper had made an about-face, at least with regard to Crémieux's legacy. And so one writer, Emile Touati, wrote a scathing revision of Crémieux's history, stating that it was not a decree made by a Jewish man in favor of his co-religionists. Instead, it was voted on by the entire French ministry. It only held Crémieux's name because he was a minister of justice at the time. Most shockingly, though, Touati claimed that it had only historical interest in 1961, because only the Algerian Jews of Crémieux's time were impacted by it, and subsequent generations were French because they were born French to French parents. It was delicate to revise the decree's history while still defending the Jews' legitimacy as French. In the summer of 61, the FLN's appeals to Jews became threatening. They warned the Jews that if they stayed in Algeria, they would not be permitted to travel to Israel, nor would they be allowed any kind of movement, really, even to France. It's therefore understandable why Jewish leaders were now trying to show that the Crémieux decree had nothing but a historical interest. Its impact was no longer immediate, but it was an older law that influenced a generation that had now passed on. They were also protecting themselves against a subsequent revocation of the law, as had occurred during the Vichy period. So this story is really about how a single emancipatory decree, on its surface unquestionably positive for the Jews of Algeria, returned to haunt them when Algeria and France were coming apart. When we teach the Algerian War, as when we teach Jewish emancipation, we have to temper the urge to tell a story of progress. The positive outcomes of the Crémieux decree, which asserted that Jews were French, were counteracted by the negative prospects for Jews in Algeria, who had to downplay the decree in order to make the very same claim to their Frenchness. This is to say nothing of contemporary tensions between Jews and Muslims in France, of course. This history of Algerian Jews offers a powerful counterhistory to the myth of emancipation and spreading republicanism. We know that the Crémieux decree functioned in the divide and rule strategy. Its passage created a resistance not just from Muslims who had to work much harder to apply for citizenship, but from the French settlers who were unwilling to welcome the Jewish minority as equals. So as a little epilogue to this story, in 1968, some of the newer leaders of the French Jewish community, including Paul Yakov, who I quoted earlier, began something called they called the Cercle Gaston Crémieux, who was Crémieux's cousin, as a way to identify away from the older establishment. Proud as secular Jews, they openly rebelled against Adolphe Crémieux's reforms, seeing them as at once as a mechanism of colonial expansion and as a force that suppressed Jews into conforming to a distinctly French norm. So Crémieux, once hailed as a savior of the oppressed, became nothing but a footnote. So thank you very much.